We are joined once again this week by Larry Dagengast, who has been taking a look over the past couple of weeks about what all this remote learning has been like in the first state, ramping up to it, getting it started. And now this week, a little bit more about what it could mean for the future of learning here in the first states. Larry, we appreciate you joining us again here on the Green this week.
As always, glad to be here.
So let's start with the near future first. What are educators you talk to saying about what's going to happen for the remainder of this school year, the end of this school year, and the start of next year? What might that bring?
Well, you know, we've talked about this a bit over the past 2 weeks. You know, and first there was this mix of confidence and hope that all would go well. And then last week, when the instruction began in most places, there was the realization that because of a combination of a shortage of tech devices and spotty internet access for students, plus the varying comfort levels of teachers, that the teachers weren't going to be able to cover nearly as much material in a distance learning environment as they would have in a regular classroom. So whether in-classroom instruction resumes on May 18th, as is now hoped, or later in the spring, or perhaps not until September, two things are pretty clear. You know, first, while schools and districts have varying expectations about how the spring semester is going to play out, the emphasis now is going to be on teaching the basic concepts for each grade, for each content area. Second, come fall, there's going to be far more emphasis on catch-up and remediation than is typical at the start of the school year. The incidence of summer learning loss, which has been well documented for a century, primarily in low-income and urban settings, is now going to extend more broadly into districts and into communities where access to technology devices and the internet is restricted.
Like so many other areas, this pandemic has really revealed some of these issues that maybe people knew about, maybe talked about a little bit, were kind of taking incremental steps to deal with, but maybe didn't take quite seriously enough. Is that something that's also kind of hitting home right now?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, in the last couple of years, we've had any number of conversations on this program about the inequities in the state's education system, imbalances in funding, and the glaring need for additional resources in schools that have high percentages of low-income students and English language learners. And now, you know, there's broad agreement that the pandemic shutdown is going to widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and it's going to manifest itself in different ways. In this crisis, we're going to be talking about how some districts have the resources to provide all their students with the with computers that they can take home from school, and how some districts are in areas where good internet connections are just about everywhere, and how other districts don't have the funds to equip their students with good technology, and how internet access can be problematic in many rural areas of the state. Heath Chazanov, who's the superintendent in the Woodward School District, which serves a rural area with lots of low-income students, puts it this way. It's going to highlight some districts that have the resources to do things that districts like mine can't do. And when all is said and done, I'm hoping that some will say, this district hit it out of the park, and ask what can be done so that many of the other districts can do the same.
As we look more long-term, your piece identifies kind of three overarching themes that you're hearing. Let's go one by one, starting with what we just talked about, kind of use of tech.
Well, first of all, this may very well prove to be a case of the adults in the system catching up with the students. I mean, after all, today's teenagers, and actually more so the preteens, have been growing up with high tech. That's kind of like all they know. And there are still a good number of teachers, good teachers, I will add, who would still have to be considered what are called reluctant adopters when it comes to using technology in their classrooms. As these teachers get some more experience with distance learning, it's likely that reluctant adopters will see some of the benefits and will develop some new skills along the way. What's that going to mean? You know, it's hard to say for sure because, well, it's early right now, and these decisions are likely to be made at the district level, and with 19 different districts in the state, you can get 19 different approaches. But still, I think that some approaches that have already been tried on a small scale might very well come into broader use. give you some examples. Schools can use distance learning to broaden their curriculum, to offer classes that might appeal to relatively small numbers of students. Take something like a course like, say, advanced placement statistics or military history. Now, if fewer than 10 students want that class, it really doesn't pay for a school to offer it. But if you can build the enrollment to 20 students or so by linking students at two schools and having them work under one teacher, it makes sense and it adds value to their curriculum. Now, for several years, the Red Clay School District has been using a closed-circuit TV system to do just that. Other schools have hooked up with a national program that's called VHS Learning. It's a virtual high school. That's an operation. VHS stands for virtual high school. And it lets students take an entire class online. Also, for the last 5 or 6 years, there have been a number of districts that have been working on what's called blended learning, which is using a combination of traditional and online instruction. And sometimes they even flip the traditional learning model. Students listen to online lectures at home and then do the problem solving that used to be considered homework in their regular classroom, where the teacher's right there to give them help if they don't understand how to do a particular problem. The point of all this is that this crisis is showing us that all learning doesn't have to go on in the classroom, and schools are now getting the opportunity, albeit forced, to find out which new approaches just might work out well.
You also noted it could change professional development for teachers. How might that change?
First of all, some of this is already happening. A teacher in the Colonial School District says the district already has a bundle of training lessons loaded onto the district's website. And teachers used these lessons last month to learn more about how to conduct distance learning activities. Now, parents, of course, are familiar with those times when the kids stay home because teachers are having in-service days. Well, given that some districts already have these training sessions for teachers saved online, it might make more sense for all teachers to take some of their annual training online rather than have the entire staff gather at the school to hear some consultant from out of state make a presentation on the very same topics. And finally, I spoke with Gary Henry, who's the dean of the University of Delaware's College of Education and Human Resources. And he says he's already set up a small task force to talk to teachers and make recommendations on how more training on distance learning might be added to the curriculum in UD's College of Education teacher prep programs.
You also mentioned in your piece that this situation could impact how snow days or other extended absences are handled. How so?
Well, okay, this idea of turning snow days into cyber days is something that school superintendents have said that they've been talking about on and off over a couple of years. Now that entire school districts are attempting distance learning for what could be as long as 4 to 6 weeks, you would think that doing it for one day in the case of a snowstorm shouldn't be all that big a deal. Now, of course, saying that is a lot easier than the implementation because this would require that all of the students in the district have their own computers and that all of them have good internet access. This is one of these disparities that we've just mentioned. So implementation isn't as easy as it might sound. Similarly, you've got students who receive out-of-school suspensions. Now, if they had a computer at home, they could engage in distance learning without disrupting the classroom. Same thing with students who are ill, might be recovering from surgery, who for one reason or another can't get into the classroom. If they could take some of their lessons online, then they might not fall as far behind.
But before we say nothing will ever be the same, there are still some obstacles to this kind of transformative change, right?
Yeah, indeed. Greater use of distance learning could serve as an equalizer, making all sorts of instructional resources available to all students, no matter where they live. But as you note, we've got some obstacles. Many of the resource-related disparities that exist in Delaware schools, whether it be the uneven availability of tech devices for students or the inadequate allocation of resources to benefit high-need students, are related to shortcomings shortcomings in the funding system that the state has been using for 50 or 60 years. Now, there is a lawsuit challenging the funding system. It's working its way through the state's Court of Chancery, and now it appears unlikely to be resolved until later this year or more likely sometime in 2021. Economic impact of this pandemic cannot be understated. It's likely that by the time the General Assembly resumes its session and begins addressing the state's budget for the next fiscal year, estimates for the state's revenue for the coming year are going to have dropped significantly. When you consider the uncertainty about the outcome of the lawsuit, and that would tend to work against significant changes in the school finance status quo, and then you put on top of that the economic impact of the pandemic on the state budget, putting it together, you can anticipate some sort of a squeeze on school funding, and that's not going to bode well if the additional use of technology proves to be a big ticket item.
And of course, there's also some who say, not so fast. You know, what's wrong with the traditional way of teaching, right?
We do hear that. But, it's not so much that there's anything wrong with traditional teaching, but, just like the assembly line workers of a generation or even less, fewer years ago had feared with some justification, automation was going to cost them their jobs. And in the same respect, teachers are understandably concerned that a move to distance learning might make some of them replaceable. However, some of the people that I talked to mentioned that online schools, there are online schools, but they're not in Delaware, don't perform as well on student assessments as the traditional brick-and-mortar school buildings do. So there is comparative evidence that classroom teachers do provide great value. And I think Anthony Passapia, who's the assistant head of Tower Hill School, phrased it pretty well, and I think this is a good point here. What he said is, education is never about the lecture. Students need to be known, and they need to know their teacher, and it's the teacher's role to turn on the lights in their minds. Those are strong words and pretty strong endorsement of the ongoing, perhaps everlasting need for classroom teachers.
Larry Nagengast, as always, thank you for your time. Thank you for your reporting. Thanks for being with us on The Green again this week.
You're quite welcome.